world peace might feel kind of like a pipe dream, but what if I told you it's not? 2024 will see more than 50 elections around the world, and in some places, peace is actually on the ballot. One reason is because countries in Europe and Latin America have been experimenting with this thing called feminist foreign policy. Because right now, the way that we wage war and peace, it's kind of a boys' club. The new season of Things That Go Boom from Inkstick Media and PRX is coming March 18th. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
The Economist.
Hello, and welcome to The Intelligence from The Economist. I'm Ora Ogunbiyi.
And I'm Jason Palmer. Every weekday, we provide a fresh perspective on the events shaping your world.
Costco, the bulk retailer, is loved by customers and investors alike. But its success is a bit of a mystery. It stocks far fewer products than its rivals and has pretty low margins. So how does it do it?
And I'm sure you're already up to date with our Carrie Bradshaw Index for American cities, which tells you where you can comfortably live alone as the Sex and the City star did. Now we've taken our methods to Europe to find the priciest places for solo living.
But first, Super Tuesday is normally a nail-biting affair. It's the day that 15 American states and one territory vote in presidential primaries. But this time around, it wasn't quite so exciting.
President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump have won most of their respective primary contests. Some of the notable states are all the states. Tennessee, where...
Donald Trump has won in all but one state. His remaining opponent, Nikki Haley, taking a surprise victory in Vermont. The only other surprise of the night saw a single loss for Joe Biden to someone with a familiar name.
40 of them went to Joe Biden, 51 of them went to Jason Palmer, and that's enough. He wins the American Samoa.
I think we can guess.
America is now set for a rematch of the 2020 election, and Mr. Trump's preparations appear to be well underway.
Donald Trump's performance on Super Tuesday and in the primary in general just makes very clear that he has been successful at transforming the Republican Party and his image.
Adam O'Neill is our Washington correspondent.
The base is fully signed up for Trump 2.0. The MAGA wing of the party is on the march. They've done very well in a contested primary election. And beyond voters, Donald Trump has also converted party officials. And this is just more proof that the Republican Party in 2024 is very much Donald Trump's, as it has been for much of the last 8 years.
So what do you mean when you say that the Republican Party has been transformed in his image?
The first thing about Donald Trump and his popularity with Republicans is it's primarily about his personality, not so much policy. They're intensely loyal to Donald Trump as a fighter, as a pugilistic candidate, as someone who they think is a proven winner. And that's not to say that there aren't policy changes. Republicans are now more blue-collar. They're more populist. In some ways, they've moved away from Reaganite ideas. Deregulation, lower taxes, that's still popular with Republicans. But things like entitlement reform that they used to discuss to fix America's pension system, that's no longer something that Republican candidates really like to talk about. Early successful candidates don't really discuss that. And there's also questions about U.S. involvement in the world, where you look at a younger generation of Republicans, and they're much more skeptical than they were during the Reagan era. You can also see this among Republican elected officials, very few of whom actually endorsed Nikki Haley or even Governor Ron DeSantis, who was running before him. Donald Trump ran in 2016 as a newcomer candidate. In 2020, he was virtually unopposed. But in 2024, he was somewhere in between where a few people were willing to challenge him in a way that they weren't in 2020. What he ultimately demonstrated is he is a quasi-incumbent with a very, very firm grip on the party. And we can see that Donald Trump is already able to maneuver as if he were the nominee.
How so?
Whenever someone wins the Republican presidential nomination, or the Democratic presidential nomination for that matter, they take over the National Committee. They put their people in at the Republican National Committee into key spots, and they integrate their campaign with the Republican National Committee to deal with things like holding events, get out the vote operations, and to split up where people are on payroll, that sort of thing. And so Donald Trump, even though he is not technically the presumptive nominee because he won't have the delegates until later this month when more states have voted, he has already been able to flex his power. First, he grew unhappy with the RNC chair, which was Ronna McDaniel. She's now resigning, and she'll be replaced by Donald Trump's hand-chosen successor, who comes from North Carolina, as the chairman of the Republican National Committee. And Lara Trump, his daughter-in-law, will serve as co-chair. He's also going to have one of his top campaign officials work as the chief operating officer of the RNC. And again, these are the sorts of things that typically happen. They're just happening much faster, even before Trump has locked up the nomination. And that's just a testament to his power within the party.
Okay, so what does that mean in practical terms? What will this mean for his presidential run?
Donald Trump will probably spend $1 billion on this campaign between get out the vote operations, advertising, paying staff, and also his very large legal bills. And by taking over the RNC, he'll be able to more seamlessly integrate what his campaign does versus what the RNC will do for him. Not everybody at the RNC is happy with a Trump takeover, especially this early. Recently, a member of the RNC tried to pass a resolution that would bar the committee from using its own funds to pay for Trump's legal fees. That didn't even have enough support to get a vote. And if it did manage to get a vote, it certainly would have failed. And that's just a way that Donald Trump was able to flex his influence even before he became the nominee. Now, that said, we should also add that a Trump campaign official made clear that they're not going to be using the RNC's money to pay for Trump's legal fees.
So this is a party dominated by one man. Is the old Republican Party still in there? Could it reemerge?
It's very difficult to know what will happen that far into the future. If Donald Trump was to lose again, and if he loses two elections in a row, will Republican voters still stick by him? Will he walk away from the political scene? One thing that's true is that there still are many Reaganite members of Congress, governors, state legislatures around the country. At the same time, there are also many populists. And a lot of Republican officials seem to be somewhere in between, trying to reconcile what the old party is with the new one. So maybe they don't want to withdraw from NATO, but they're a little more skeptical of foreign intervention. And I think that whenever Trump leaves the political scene, the party won't be the same once he leaves, but we also don't know if it will be fully remade in his image in the way that he might like it to be.
But for now, it's his party. Now that we're past Super Tuesday, what might change?
Campaigns are very expensive, and a lot of very well-heeled Republican donors backed Nikki Haley, backed Ron DeSantis, Chris Christie, many of these other challengers. The first question is how many of them are going to come back around? The very influential Club for Growth has already kissed and made up with Donald Trump, despite very vigorously opposing him in the primary. It will be interesting to see how many Republican donors change their mind and decide that even if they would have preferred a DeSantis or a Haley, Republicans like Donald Trump are still going to be superior to Joe Biden. The second question is what Trump himself is going to do in terms of changing his message. I was speaking to a member of the Republican National Committee earlier who basically said, Trump has some work to do to come back to us and say, hey, I still want you to be in the party. We're all in this together. It was a tough primary against Nikki Haley, but she's a good governor. I want her to come out and help me win this thing. Donald Trump can be very vindictive. He can also sometimes have a unifying message. So he's going to have to make a decision about how he wants to approach his former rivals, particularly ones that had very sharp criticism of him.
And what about his broader campaign strategy? Will we see that change at all?
Typically, presidential candidates adjust their message between the primary and the general election. Donald Trump didn't really do that in 2016, and it doesn't look like he's going to do it again here in 2024. That essentially means that he's going to be continuing to contrast his record as president with Joe Biden's. He'll be hitting Joe Biden on the economy. He'll be hitting Joe Biden on immigration. He'll be hitting Joe Biden on chaos around the world. One question, though, is whether Donald Trump takes a more moderate position on abortion. Will he have a more liberal position, if not outright pro-choice, allowing more exceptions or having a certain cutoff date that is more palatable to a general election audience? That's something that could happen. But fundamentally, this is Donald Trump, and he's an incredibly unpredictable political actor, and he doesn't always act in his own best interest politically or personally. So we're just going to have to wait and find out how he behaves and how he campaigns.
Adam, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me on.
What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico is more than just a tropical paradise. It's an innovations paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, Puerto Rico has the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, this is the place to bring it. Find out more at investpr.org/economist.
There's a certain feeling you get when you walk into the Costco warehouse. Anticipation. You never know what free samples you might find that day. Or where else in the world can you get a 32-pack of toilet roll, your car tires, a mattress, and a shrimp ring? I'm not a regular, but I'm one of those more outside of the inner circle of shoppers, tagging along on everyone else's membership. But Costco does have its real devotees. And it's not just the shoppers that are enamored with the brand.
The Economist has published the Big Mac Index for nearly 40 years now. And during the time, the price of a McDonald's burger in America, which is the basis of the index, has more than tripled. Now, in that same period, the price of another American fast food staple, the hot dog and soda combo at Costco, has been fixed at $1.50.
Shailesh Chitnis is a global business correspondent for The Economist and, like me, a more casual Costco shopper.
And last year, some of Costco's customers ate almost 200 million of these. Now, there's a popular story about how Jim Sinegal, who was the co-founder of the company, once threatened to kill then-CEO if the combo price was changed. Now, that's a joke, of course, but it does show how important that 150 price point is to the company.
Okay, while I personally love the Costco hot dogs, that doesn't sound like a great business model, Shailesh. How do they manage it?
Sure. But before getting into the business model, it's probably good to highlight just how successful Costco is. So the company is the world's third biggest retailer behind Walmart and Amazon. In the last 5 years, its share price has been up by 235%, which is way, way more than any other American retail company. And last year, its sales were around $235 billion. And even though that number is probably 40% of Walmart's sales, Costco makes more profit per employee, and sales per unit of retail space are almost three times as that of Walmart. Now, coming back to your question, the secret to their success is actually quite simple. They want to hook shoppers by offering the highest quality products at the lowest price.
Okay, so you say its secret to success is simple, but tell me a little more about it.
So the first thing that Costco does is it keeps its markups, which is essentially the difference between what a retailer buys and what it sells at, very, very low. So to give you some numbers, Walmart's gross margins are around 25%. For Costco, their gross margins are less than half of that, around 12%. So the shopper is essentially getting it at a much, much cheaper cost. Now, to make up the difference, what Costco does is it charges its shoppers an annual membership fee to be able to shop at their stores. And the customers pay around either $60 or slightly more than that if it's a premium account. And these fees start to add up. Last year, the company earned almost $4.6 billion from its 130 million members. And that number is more than half of Costco's operating profits.
So is it just that? A membership fee?
That's part of it. The other part is making sure that it stocks fewer distinct products. Now, that may seem a bit counterintuitive for a retailer. Most American supermarkets will stock around 30,000 different products. A Walmart superstore keeps around 120,000. In contrast, Costco stores have a limited selection of only about 3,800 distinct items. And there's a very good reason for this. What they do is by stocking very few products, they ensure that they only keep the best quality products. And what that does is by having fewer suppliers, they have a greater bargaining power, which means they can push for lower prices, which, like we discussed, get passed on to the customers. And so it's almost like a virtuous cycle that keeps repeating. The customers are happy. Costco's membership renewal rates are upwards of 90%. Now, one other thing that the company does is it also pays its employees really well in terms of average hourly wages, as well as offers benefits in terms of health and retirement as well. And what that does is it helps reduce attrition. So in retail, where typical annual employee turnover hovers at around 60%, Costco's turnover rate is only 8%. And more than a third of its workers have been at the company for more than 10 years. These are very unusual numbers in the retail industry.
But Shailesh, if it is so simple, why don't more stores adopt this strategy?
That's a great question. Now, Costco's business model isn't a secret, and Walmart has Sam's Club, which is the same warehouse membership model. But I think what sets the company apart is its culture. When I spoke with its outgoing CFO, Richard Galanti, a large part of our conversation was not on numbers, but was on employee culture. And the entire organization, from storefront employees to top management, are very clear about what their mission is. I don't think that is very easy to replicate. In fact, the late Charlie Munger, who was Warren Buffett's second-in-command at Berkshire Hathaway, served on Costco's board from 1997 until his death last year. And in his own words, he called it the perfect damn company. So I think Costco shoppers can expect many more years of the $150 hot dogs.
Well, thank God for that. Shailesh, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Carrie Bradshaw from Sex and the City.
Finding the perfect apartment in New York City is like finding the perfect partner. It can take years.
She's a shopaholic writer living in a New York City brownstone alone. For anyone looking at apartments in the Big Apple, her story may seem unrealistic given the current cost of renting. And in fact, it is. In 2023, The Economist created the Carrie Bradshaw Index to measure the affordability of renting alone in America's largest cities. Unsurprisingly, perhaps, New York was the priciest among them. But we couldn't help but wonder, are there better deals to be had across the Atlantic?
So we've looked at affordability in 35 European cities, ranging from Ankara to Oslo.
Lizzie Peet is a researcher at The Economist and, like Carrie Bradshaw, is based in New York.
Some are pretty well known to be expensive cities, but they're actually far more affordable for renters than you might imagine. And others are kind of the opposite. So it's been really interesting to look at the differences across Europe.
So before we get into the rankings, let's look at the sort of the mechanism here. How does the Bradshaw Index actually work?
So we basically begin by calculating the wage needed to comfortably afford the average one-bedroom flat in each city, which we've called our recommended renter's wage. We basically go by the rule of thumb that you shouldn't really spend more than 30% of your wage on rent to stay in budget and balance your own books. And we've compared this number with the average salary in each city to get the Bradshaw score. So basically, the higher the Bradshaw score, the more affordable it is to rent. Anything under one is considered unaffordable, and anything over one is considered affordable. So if the average salary is half our recommended wage, the score is 0.5.
Okay, now let's get to the meat of it. What do the numbers show?
I mean, there are some pretty wild differences in livability across European cities. Look at London and Geneva, for example. So we calculated that the recommended renter's wage was just over $95,000 in each city. And by the way, we've used dollars to compare the countries easier, as obviously there are a wide range of currencies. So in Geneva, that's actually only $4,000 more than the average wage. But an average Londoner makes about $31,000 less than this. So there's obviously quite a big gap there between those two numbers. But even so, London doesn't actually crack into the top five least affordable cities in our ranking.
It gets way worse than London then, does it? Which are the worst offenders?
It gets quite a lot worse, yeah. So actually, Budapest in Hungary is the priciest city for renters. That's obviously in relative terms. So again, comparing the average wage in Budapest to what we think our affordable rent wage would be. It had the highest inflation rate of any EU country for most of 2023, which might explain why rents have been pushed up. Other really unaffordable cities on our list are Prague, Lisbon, and Dublin. So various factors we think might explain why these cities in particular have this affordability issue. In Lisbon, there was an influx of digital nomads during COVID, people that were allowed to work anywhere, and that might have helped push the rents up. In Dublin, there's quite a well-documented housing shortage, and actually two-thirds of 18 to 34-year-olds live with their parents, which is one of the highest in Europe. So we look at all these cities and various different factors explain why rents may be higher than economically they should be.
And what about at the other end of the spectrum? Tell me where I can go live for really cheap.
So the winner of our index, if you will, the most affordable city was actually Bonn in Germany, the old capital of West Germany. There, the average salary of $53,000 is pretty significantly higher than the $36,000 that you would need to rent a loan affordably. Other cities that do pretty well are the Swiss capital of Bern and Karlsruhe, another German city. Although if you want to get closer to Paris, which we reckon Carrie Bradshaw may want to, as it's obviously Europe's fashion capital, you could also settle for Lyon, where the average wage of $45,000 is pretty, again, high above the $34,000 needed for a one-bedroom apartment.
Fabulous. I will pack my bags now. Lizzie, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks very much for having me, Jason.
That's all for this episode of The Intelligence. Don't forget, we have a sale on our Economist Podcast Plus subscriptions at the moment. So if you've been pondering diving into our weekly feature shows, our limited series, and our longer weekend edition of The Intelligence, there's no better time to join us than now. Until March 17th, you can get an annual or a two-year plan for less than $2.50 a month. A bargain, I know. All the details you need are in the show notes, and we'll see you back here tomorrow.
Seven in 10 full-time workers would consider switching jobs for better benefits. Benefit strategies are crucial to building a competitive advantage. But how can employers meet diverse priorities across industries and demographics? Benefits 2.0 from Economist Impact, supported by Nuveen, a TIAA company, explores how benefits empower individuals, elevate companies, and drive the U.S. economy. Search Economist Impact Benefits 2.0 to learn more. Sponsored by Nuveen, a TIAA company.